the World Shapers, conversations with science fiction and fantasy authors about the creative process. I'm your host, Edward Willett, and this episode's guest, M.C.A. Hogarth. Welcome to another episode of The World Shapers, the podcast where I talk to other science fiction and fantasy authors about the creative process. My name is Edward Willett. I'm your host. I am myself an author of science fiction and fantasy. And in fact, I have a new book to mention this time around. Way back in 1997, my very first novel was published just over 25 years ago. It was called Soulworm, young adult fantasy novel. It was shortlisted for Best First Book at the Saskatchewan Book Awards that year. And I've been meaning to bring it out in a new edition. And of course, I kind of missed the boat because last year would have been its silver anniversary. I missed that by a year, but there is now a new edition, slightly revised by me, of Soulworm. And Soulworm was originally written in the 1980s, and I've left it in the 1980s. So what was a contemporary fantasy is now almost a historical fantasy. And it very deliberately, the cover art echoes the font from Stranger Things because it is set in the 80s. And it's set in Weyburn, Saskatchewan, which is where I lived at the time. As I modified for story purposes Weyburn, Saskatchewan, but I call it Weyburn, and it's basically what it is. And it's about a young acolyte of a race of priestesses in an alternate world who accidentally, really, gets thrown into our world in pursuit of a soul worm. And these are spirit creatures, not really demons, but you could think of them like that, who possess people and drive them to acts of violence and hatred, and that's what they feed off of. So there's an explosion of violence, and as it grows, the soul worms spread and can wreak a lot of havoc. And Earth, of course, is totally unprotected because they don't have these priestesses who fight the soul worms in their own realm. The trouble is that the priestess from the other realm, Liepel, is not really prepared. She wasn't supposed to be sent. And not only that, when she gets there, she finds herself trapped inside the mind of a Weyburn teenager, Marybeth, who has been in a coma after a car accident. She wakes up. Liepel is just riding piggyback, and Marybeth knows nothing about what's going on, but it's her best friend, former best friend, Christine, who has been possessed by the soul worm, and so things take a dark turn. So there you go. That's soul worm, and eventually Liepel does wake up and is able to battle it, as you might expect, which that's complicated by the fact that everybody thinks she's actually Marybeth, the teenager from Weyburn. It was a fun story to write. I kind of remember writing it a long time ago now, but I was very pleased when it came out and was shortlisted for Best First Book. And now it's out in a new edition from my Shadowpaw Press Reprise, which specializes in new editions of notable previously published work. You can find it everywhere, or you can go to shadowpawpress.com, or you can go to Books to Read, numeral 2, bookstoread.com/soulworm, and that'll point you to various other sources of it. It's available in ebook and audiobook. And as long as I'm talking about Shadowpaw Press, I can't remember if I mentioned this last time, but I'm pleased to be able to announce that Shadowpaw Press is now a member of Literary Press Group Canada. This is a collection of about 60 small presses from across Canada that have combined their combined efforts there to market and distribute and generally boost their publishing efforts and to boost the production of literary work in Canada. So I'm very, very pleased that Shadowpaw Press has been accepted into that organization. What else should I mention? That's probably about it. If you're looking for more traditional science fiction from me, the most recent thing from Daw Books, my 12th novel from Daw, is The Tangled Stars. You can find that everywhere as well, in audiobook and ebook only. A far future outer space adventure featuring an AI-uplifted talking cat who becomes starship captain. So please do look for that one as well. And I think that's it for this time around. So let's get on to this episode's guest, M.C.A. Hogarth. Daughter of two Cuban political exiles, M.C.A. Hogarth was born a foreigner in the American melting pot and has had a fascination for the gaps in cultures and the bridges that span them ever since. She has been many things: web database architect, product manager, technical writer, and massage therapist. probably not at the same time, but is currently a full-time parent, artist, writer, and anthropologist to aliens, both human and otherwise. Her fiction has variously been recommended for a Nebula, a finalist for the Spectrum, placed on the Tiptree long list, and chosen for two Best of Anthologies. Her art has appeared in RPGs, magazines, and on book covers. And she served as vice president of the Science Fiction and Fantasy Writers of... Well, it's not the Science Fiction and Fantasy Writers of America anymore, is it? It's the Science Fiction and Fantasy Writers Association, they call it now, I believe, for 3 years. Her current focus is new business models for artists and independent marketing and distribution innovations. And as she says, it is an exciting time to be working in the arts. Her first crowd-funded fiction project kicked off in 2004, before the word even coined. And she has experimented with everything from choose-your-own-adventure-style serials online to kickstarting creative projects, something I've been doing, and is looking forward to future experiments in using technology to bring art directly to the audience. So, welcome to the World Shapers. Now, do I call you MCA? Is that...
No. We have this conversation all the time, and some of my friends tell me I should pick a name like Sting that everyone would just call me. And I'm like, but I can't ever come up with something cool enough. So no, my name is Maggie.
Maggie, okay. That's easier than, well, MCA. You sound like a rapper if I call you that, MCA.
Oh my gosh.
So I usually look for connections here. I don't know that we've ever met at a convention or anything. I don't think we have.
No, I think I stopped doing the convention circuit in the early 2000s.
Well, I haven't been to one for a long time, so.
I went to the Worldcon and ShyCon in 2000.
I was there.
Yeah, there you go.
That's some sort of connection.
There you go.
The Kickstarter thing is a connection because I literally just finished a Kickstarter last week. The fourth one I've done for anthologies featuring guests of this podcast. You'll be invited to be in the next one.
Oh, exciting.
It's something I've been getting into and maybe doing more of as well as I try to, fund various creative projects.
I have done 19.
Oh, we should talk. Oh, we are. I read your bit of biography, but let's start at the very beginning, a very good place to start. And take me back in time to your upbringing and how you got started in this whole writing biz.
Oh, I don't know. I guess we all are interested. I guess most children's books are fantasy books, aren't they?
Most of them, even, it seems like, yeah.
Even things like Wind in the Willows, and, they're all kind of fantastical. And I guess I just never stopped liking that kind of thing, and then just kept going. And my mother, not so much, but my dad was very much into science fiction and fantasy, so he was a big fan. And I think I imbibed some of that from him. I guess when I was a teenager, I got into comic books, like independent comic books. And so there was a very niche, small independent comic book, a couple of them, that I think kind of set a template for me in terms of, you can do this kind of thing and it's fun. And one of them was by Steve Galacci, and it was called Albedo, and it was kind of like uplifted animals in space. And I thought, wow, people take this seriously? That's pretty cool. And the other one was called Xanadu by Vicky Wyman, which was kind of a pulpy story about also about animals, but in a fantasy kingdom. And they had social casts based on whether they were domestic animals, wild animals, or mythical creatures. And of course, the mythical creatures were on top and the domestic animals were on the bottom. And I thought that was a kind of interesting use of animals and to do something with social critique while also having fun and doing pulpy stuff, because it was super pulpy, but really fun comic. Really enjoyed it. So I think, I started with reading classic fairy stories, and then I got into, Anne McCaffrey, and I guess that would have been the early 80s science fiction that was out, and then independent comics, and then I just sort of ended up where I am.
So how did the writing, and also you're also an artist, so how did those things kick in? Did that start when you were young? Did you start writing stories very young and drawing pictures?
Oh, yeah. I always did them together. I think some part of me wanted to be an animator, but you can't,
I went through that.
Yeah, you can't really control the stories when you're an animator. You don't really, and it's a really, even back then, it was a very hard job to get into. And at the time, I guess I moved from New Orleans to Florida. And so when they opened, and it was much later, when they opened MGM Studios and you could see the animators working, I was like, oh, this is so cool. I wish I could do this. And then I thought about it a little harder. I'm like, okay, no, maybe not.
Yeah, I sort of, the same way, I thought it would be so cool to draw pictures and make them come to life. But then I found out there's like 24 of them per second.
Well, and it's just, it's a collaborative, it's like movies. It's a collaborative thing. And you don't get to decide what the story is until you're way far into the career. So I'm like, okay, maybe not effective.
I would imagine with computer animation tools that it's much easier for an individual to tell their own stories through animation now than it was when everything was hand-drawn.
You know, some people really get into it and, you know, more power to them. I've done a couple of animations when I first got my tablet and I'm like, oh, this is cool. And then I thought, yeah, but no, this would take me forever. I can write a book in 2 months. I'm not going to animate a movie in 2 months. So I need to keep moving. But I've always drawn as part of my creative process. And now I do my own book covers because I can. And so I guess it's there's no real separating them for me.
Where did you grow up?
I was born in New Orleans, actually. And I didn't move from New Orleans until I was about 12. And then I came to Florida at that point.
There's a city I think contributes to fantasy.
You know, New Orleans is it's an incredible city. Not great for children. Not really a family-friendly city. But there's so much. So I came, you know, I had parents who were not American. And so I already had a sense that there were cultural things that I didn't understand in both directions, you know, both about America and about where they came from. And when you go to New Orleans, you also feel the history in it and the competing cultures and the competing societies in it and the traditions that are so old that people don't remember why they happened. And it was very rich that way, that even when you're really young, you soak it in. And I thought that was very interesting. And I kind of miss it. Not enough to go back because it's not really a city for families. But it was a very useful thing, I think, to have been raised there for a bit.
When you were writing and drawing as a young person, were you sharing your stories with other people, or was it something you kind of kept to yourself?
Oh, no. I was all about, let me show you my things. And I would, you know, well, and my parents encouraged my drawing. The writing didn't happen till much later because you have to, it takes more time. It is more difficult to notice children being good writers than it is to notice them being good artists. So they were very encouraging with the art. And I was always happy to share it with everybody. I had big plans, even when I was young. Well, I find drawings that I did in elementary school that I dated on the back because I was convinced that some archivist would eventually want to know when it was done for my museum piece or whatever. I'm like, oh my gosh, ambitious child.
It's still cool for you to have those dates and know exactly when you did something.
Yeah, but she saved everything. So now I have a household with literally boxes in the attic full of things. And I'm at the point now where I'm trying to archive everything digitally. And the scope of work of what do I save? What do I throw away? How do I keep it? How do I index it? How do I catalog it? Is just, where do I put it? Is enormous. It's an enormous task. I don't even want to think what's going to happen in another 20 years when I have another 20 years of stuff to do this with. I have to get a handle on it now.
Oh, I don't know. We have one daughter, and my wife has inherited everything from her mom, who was a single daughter. So we have a house full of stuff dating back to when this house was purchased, which was 1939 and before.
Oh, my gosh.
And it's all coming down on our daughter at some point.
Oh, my gosh. No, I'd like to prevent her from having that problem.
Yeah, I would too, but I'm not sure it's going to happen. So did you study writing or art at some point formally?
Well, let's see. I had a couple of art classes when I was young, outside of school, that my mother arranged for. And they were not super effective, but it was enjoyable. I mean, I got something out of them. And then I went to school, I went to college, and then in college, I took some writing classes and I hated them. And then I went into fine art, hoping that they would teach me to paint without realizing that fine art colleges do not teach you process or method or technique. They teach you whatever they feel like it. it was an interesting experience. So I didn't actually learn much art in arts. It wasn't an art school. It was a college with a university with an art college. But I got an art degree, technically in studio painting, but they never taught me painting technique. It was a very useful experience, though, because having my own goals, which conflicted with the goals that the school had for teaching me, was an exercise in every other skill that you needed. Perseverance and persuasion and stubbornness and keeping going when other people want you to fail and all those other things that you can't plan to learn, but you end up learning anyway. So yeah, I did not actually learn much painting in my painting degree. I think I have part of a minor in linguistics as well, but then they shut down the linguistics program, which was kind of annoying.
See, I actually minored in art. So
did you? Yeah. And they shut down my master's program too. I was a third of the way into my master's program, which is in bioethics and medical humanities. And they shut that down too. And I'm like, okay, well, I'm never finishing that degree then. But so no.
Starts to feel personal after a while.
I know. And it was at the same school both times. So.
We can't let her have that.
So yeah, I guess I've had on and off again classes, but mostly in art, and then writing, not really, but Damon Knight's book was hugely influential.
I have it just to my left. If I turn around, I can see it.
I was not a fan of short fiction, but everything, all the advice he gave you in creating short fiction was good enough to learn to write novels. It was great advice. So
when did you start writing for publication?
Well, okay, let's see. The first novel I ever wrote was in junior high. Finished, I would say. The first thing I finished was
How
in junior
was
high.
How long was it?
It was 386 pages.
Oh, that is long for a junior high novel.
And I know that because I wrote the page number on the top of each loose leaf page as I filled it, or otherwise they would have gotten shuffled up and I would have them out of order. And I was convinced this was going to be a published novel, but of course it wasn't. And then I guess the first book I finished that I wanted after that as an adult was in college, I guess. It was like 95, and it was 256,000 words.
A long one.
Yeah, it was long. And that one was accepted by a small press, but I didn't like their terms, so I said no to them. So I guess, and then I sold, I guess it was in the 90s, I said, all right, I'm in college and I want to be a writer. I got to be serious about this. And then I started buying the writer's guide for, they had the, back before the internet, they had those big books where you had to look up the
writer's market.
Magazines. Yeah, the markets. So I bought one of those and I started.
I used to get one every year.
Yes, me too. So I started doing that in the 90s and I sold my first story to a professional market in 2000. So, you know, I guess I'd been writing all my life, but then I didn't really start taking it seriously until the late 90s.
Well, you did do a lot of other things in there.
Did I?
Well, according to your bio, web database architect, product manager, technical writer, massage therapist.
Well, you know, day jobs. And the day jobs were important because they made you get out in the world and interact with people and learn things. And
that's what I was going to ask, because it is kind of a varied thing. So does that feed into your writing, the experience you had doing all these other things?
Oh, you know, to this day, I think I'm one of the only science fiction writers who bases story conflicts on whether or not alarm systems work. Because if you work in computing, you know there's the computer system, the radar system, the cell phone system, and then there's a separate system that watches over all those components and then tells somebody if one of them fails. And so if that system doesn't work correctly, then you're not notified if something fails in the actual network. And so I've written at least three stories that have that as a plot point. And I'm like, I would never have known that if I hadn't been involved in process management in a telecom company. It's ridiculous.
Yes, but has the massage therapy ever worked into a story?
Well, you know, after I started massage, and that was actually a lot harder than, we actually had anatomy tests where you had to know all the muscles of the body, where they insert, where they attach, and then all the muscle movements they create. So you had to memorize all that stuff. After that, my art got better.
Oh, I can imagine, yeah.
Yeah, so it was huge for, and I had so many stories from massage therapy because people treated you like dirt. and they said things that, you know, it's almost as if they think that you're a piece of furniture. And so they just talk. Like, I had one woman on a cell phone the entire time I was working on her, complaining about her ex and, you know, the divorce and all that. And then she came out and she's like, that was the least relaxing massage I've ever had. And I'm thinking, were you even there? I mean, oh my gosh. So a lot of human stories came out. Oh, but the best human story of that was I had a little old granny come in and she's like, I'd like a massage. I'm like, okay. So I'm working on her and I'm like, this arm is really bad. And she's like, you can tell? And I said, yes, I can tell. And I said, and it's almost as if you're doing this motion and I demonstrate. She goes, oh, yes, you see, I'm a competitive cross stitcher. I'd never heard of competitive cross stitching in my life, but this woman actually had injuries from competitive cross stitching. So it was great stuff.
Yeah, well, you don't pick that up just by reading usually.
No, definitely not.
And talking to people. Did you write a lot of short fiction or did you plunge straight into novels?
You know, I hate short fiction. No.
I'm still going to ask you to be part of the next anthology, but
that's okay. I've gotten over it, but you know, I'm naturally a long form writer, and when I mean long form, I mean multiple novels, not like even three or four, I mean 20 plus. I want to tell a story that big. So learning to write short stories was hard. And of course, in the beginning, you'll probably remember, they used to tell us, you need to write short stories in order to get the interest of agents who will want mm-hmm. your novel. So I gamely went and wrote lots of short stories, and they were not fantastic. I mean, they were okay, and tried to get going with that until I finally wrote some that were good enough to be published. But it's a form that I had to learn. And so the breaking point for me, I guess, was I had a job as a technical writer for a software company, and they put me to work writing tooltips. So I had 6 to 8 words maximum to indicate what something was going to do when you hovered over it. And I'm like, oh my gosh. So I made lots of tooltips, and then they're like, okay, you need to write the little help sections that are going to be one paragraph long, and those paragraphs have to tell them exactly what they have to know. So after that, I'm like, okay, I guess I'll practice this micro fiction thing. And then I did a flash fiction project, and I wrote 50 pieces of flash fiction to teach myself to write really, really, really short. And at that point, I felt like I finally, like, some switch flipped and I was able to do it more easily, but it's still more of an effort than writing a book is.
Yeah, I think people definitely gravitate to one or the other. I put out, when I started my publishing company 5 years ago, one of the first things I put out was a collection of my short fiction. But at that point I had been writing for, 40 years, and that didn't take me that long to have enough short stories to put into a book, so I don't write a lot of them either. Well, let's talk about your creative process then.
My creative process.
Yes, and we're going to, because I have to focus on something to make that work, and I've talked to you beforehand, we will talk about the Pelted Peltedverse. There we go.
Peltedverse. You know, I didn't name it. The fans named it.
So. Yeah, I was going to say that probably wasn't what you called it.
No.
The first book was Earthrise. So yeah. Tell me about that series as kind of an overview, and then we'll talk about how it came about and how the writing of the books in that series exemplifies how you write any book.
Oh my. Okay. So Earthrise. So Earthrise is space opera. It is supposed to be fun, adventure, romance-y, kind of the kind of stuff that you read just for fun on a Saturday afternoon while, you know, eating popcorn or whatever. So it was supposed to be, and in the style of, because I haven't realized this until recently, but I'm still writing in the style of the books that I grew up reading in science fiction.
I do too.
Which were a lot pulpier than modern books. Modern books are very they're very different in pacing and style. And I'm still doing things that should have, you know, Jody Lee covers and Michael Whelan covers. Mm. That's just the way I've focused on it. So it's space opera. It's supposed to be fun. It is about a Martian space trader who has very bad luck and has. It is not doing well in terms of money. And then she gets involved with a spy from a very mysterious alien race that are kind of like space elves, because I like elves. So I put them in my science fiction. So
and isn't Spock a space elf with the pointy ears?
You know, I loved Spock. I loved that that combination of here's the impetuous, passionate one. Here's the cool analytical one, and here's the sentimental specialist one. I thought that was a great dynamic. Mm-hmm. I love dynamics like that. So anyway, Earthrise actually happened because I wrote a short story, which, you know, I was at the point where short stories still weren't my thing, and it was about. It was about aliens and humans working together. And a rejection I got about it was that it was unbelievable to the editor that aliens would work that well with humans. And I'm like, what genre are you even reading? How can you? Okay. So I got angry and I'm like, I'm just going to take this and write many aliens in one place, all being friends and doing something together useful. And so that was kind of the genesis for the crew. And then I just threw in the space elves because I love space elves. So anyway, the entire thing is an arc, and it travels from through multiple planets with exotic locales, and then it gets to the space elf planet, which we get to see, which is so mysterious. And it's they're my answer to the question of, if elves were really real, the way we portray them in fiction, how would that work? I mean, wouldn't their society fall apart if they were all poets and artists and craftspersons and nobody did any farming? So I decided to ask the question of, what would you do if you told all those people who wanted to live the elf lifestyle that they would go colonize the planet and then it would fall apart because it has no infrastructure and it has no... There's no practical anything. So they have to go be involved in rescuing the space elves from themselves. And so that's part of one of the main themes of the entire setting is, what do we do with this culture? And then there's like a war, because why wouldn't you have a war in a space opera? And then there's, what does war do to culture and the way people interact and all that? So... you know, it's actually I put out a 10th anniversary edition of Earthrise last year because that was the anniversary of its publication date, 10 years. But I actually wrote it pretty long ago, mid-2000s maybe. And it was all because I wanted, you know, a fun kind of action adventure romance-y thing with, you know, rescuing elves in space with aliens.
How many books are there in the series?
Okay, so that series is four books, because I did a holiday novella that turned into a holiday novel. And nobody's
surprised.
So
like the Star Wars holiday special.
Yes, hopefully better. That series is four books, and then the rest of the setting, which is all intertwined. It's people are like, where do I start? Because everything's intertwined. I'm like, you can start wherever you want because you'll eventually end up in the middle. But then there's a 7-book war series and a 6-book pastoral series. And then there's a 8-book after the war series. And then there's a 9-book military science fiction series. And they're all kind of part of the same universe at around the same time.
Well, I'm going to ask the question that you're not supposed to ask, but I ask it because it is a legitimate question. If you don't like the question, where do you get your ideas? Then you can think, from what seeds do these massive plants of fiction grow? Or something like that. But
I don't mind the question. I think all artists have themes that interest them, and they're basically the questions that make us want... They're the questions we can't answer satisfactorily, easily. So, you know, you can say, oh, wouldn't it be cool if, wouldn't it be cool if I could grow a garden? Well, you can go grow a garden and find out if it is cool or not. But you can't really ask yourself, well, what would it be like how would you fix a dying culture? You can't answer that question. How do you integrate the immigrant's experience? Well, you don't know. How do I deal with death and getting old? Well, you don't know. None of those things have satisfactory answers. And I came to the conclusion recently that all the art I've made, because the Pelted Verse was started in notebooks in junior high, and there are characters that are that old that are still in the canon that my junior high self would recognize. And my first published book was actually a collection of short fiction that I wrote in high school. And it was not, you know, the editor of that small press chose to do that, and he collected them and he sold it. But those are now part of the canon, is the stuff that I was doing in high school. So I have had to look back at decades of work in the same setting, often with the same characters, and say, I need to be okay with the things I was thinking as a young person, as well as the things I'm thinking now, even though artistically I would not have made the same choices. And I did that by realizing that the themes are all the same. I keep revolving around the same themes and just answering it in different ways. You know, teenage me had a different answer than mother me has now. And it's all, what is the role of faith? And what is, you know, how do you live a life of meaning? And how do you be a hero? And how do you make a difference? All these things, it's just the same stuff. And it's the stuff that you feel the strongest about, that you keep writing about, just in a different way. So I guess where I get my ideas is, what are the questions that most concern you, the existential questions that can't be answered? And then all the other stuff on top is just like, it's like clothing that you put on over those things.
It sounds like you're starting almost with the theme in mind before you built the story around it.
Well, I don't even know if I used to do that. I used to be, you know, I just think this would be cool. And then later I'd look back and say, oh, but see, look, here running through everything is the same theme. So now, you know, 20, 30 years later, I can say, well, these are the themes that matter to me right now. What can I say about, what vessel can I use to talk about them in a new way that I might find something new about it? And then I build from there, usually. It used to be the other way around, that I educated myself about my themes by writing, and then I'd just stumble into them. But see, goes back to something I've always thought, which is that advice that works for new writers does not work for older writers, and vice versa. You can't give the same kind of advice to new writers that you do to people who have been doing it for years and years, because the process evolves. You know, when new writers say, where do I get my ideas? I just tell them, where should I get my ideas? I tell them, look, what is the story that you're like, why hasn't anybody written this? Because I'm bored of reading this. Write the thing that you're like, where is my ex? That's the thing that you should be working on. But when you're talking to someone who's been doing it for long enough, they're just different. the process changes, I think.
Yeah, I think so too. And I started, like I have on my desk here, I can still see them, the three novels I wrote in high school. So, although mine were shorter, I was just looking at them. They came in at about 170 pages, maybe max, but typed.
That's still big. That's still big.
Wasn't bad. And they started out in handwriting because, well, I wasn't.
That's typing what we did. On the computer. That's what we did. Oh my gosh!
In fact, the first one I do have the handwritten version of it as well, so it's funny. I know exactly when I started it because it's dated, and I was 14 years old.
There you go.
So once you have this kernel of an idea, what's your planning process look like? Both for a book and for a series. I mean, did you plan this series as a series from the beginning, or did it grow?
No, I think I knew it had to be long enough for the. You know, you want. Yeah, you can write. So I guess, did I do a YouTube about this? I think I did. So the length of the story depends on how you attack it and where you start it and how much you want to get into it. So I tend to get into, I want all the expositional and the buildup. I like the buildup because I think that the payoff feels so much more satisfying when you have all the buildup. So I always try to think in terms of very long story arcs, multiple books leading somewhere. And so like the one I'm leading towards now is I've been working on for over 27 years or something. So it's I like long things. But I when I started writing professionally, I kind of took a look at the two ways that you can do series, right? You can do continuous series where each book follows the next book and you have like 28 books in the series and you have to read all of them to get to where you want. So that's things like Harry Dresden, Anita Blake, that style of series writing. And then you have the Mercedes Lackey. Here are clusters of series within a setting that you can enter into at any point, but it's a little bit harder to keep track of where you should go next because they're all separate. So I said, well, how do I want to approach things? And I decided I kind of liked the separate book approach better. And I guess part of that was because at the time when we, can I say we started, when we started, you had to go trad pub because there was no indie.
Yes, I predate you by quite a bit is when I started trying to get published, although actually okay. Getting published, I think we overlapped.
So you had to go through the traditional industry. And so you got used to writing a book one of a series and then dropping it if nobody wanted it and writing a book one of a new series and dropping it if nobody. So you end up with a lot of starts. And so it's good not to get too attached to that first book because you might not be able to sell it. So because I started that way, I said, I'm going to go with the multiple series in the same setting style. Otherwise, you know, I might never sell anything. I don't want to get invested in something I won't be able to sell. So I kind of plan things in trilogies, or I try. Sometimes they get too long. And then I guess by now, it's very different now than what it used to be. The one thing that hasn't changed is I still draw. So I do a lot of drawing while I'm brainstorming. That's part of my brainstorming process. I draw the characters. I draw scenes that I think are going to be important. I draw maybes, like, will this happen? And then I look at the picture and I'm like, yes, no, maybe. I don't know. Maybe not. So I do a lot of sketching while I am brainstorming. And I discovered that it's almost like part of my outlining process is to have the art, which means part of the archiving that I'm doing is I need to restore the memories I have of all these outlines because they're all scattered around as pictures. So I do the brainstorming that way. And then I just follow, you know, each book should have a satisfying ending, something that makes you say, okay, that was worth the climax, because I love endings. I think ever since I read The Lord of the Rings when I was a kid, I love that denouement. I love that like 20% of that book is just what happened after all the action. And I thought that was so good. It was so satisfying. And I said, I want all my books to make you feel that sense of satisfaction. So I want every book to end on something that makes you feel like some good question has been answered that was raised. That gets harder when you have series that are like 6 or 7 books long. Sometimes you just kind of have to end on a cliffhanger, but I try to at least answer one thing that I've raised in each book so that you have that moment of closure. And then after that, it's just a matter of what do I need to get to this point and what do I need to come down to that point? And then you just fill in everything in between.
So what does your outline look like in the end, aside from the pictures?
Well, I used to be a pantser. A discovery writer. I used to be a pantser. And like most people still seem to be, I was very attached to the idea that I was a pantser until a friend of mine was like, well, just try outlining. So I'm like, okay, I'll try outlining. So I tried outlining and I'm like, actually, this isn't bad. So now I think of those things less as identities and more as tools. So sometimes a story is so short or you write it so fast that you don't need an outline. And sometimes the story is so convoluted and so it requires so much attention to detail that you outline it even if it's short. So sometimes my outlines are very, very thick and very heavy. And sometimes they're just bullet points of just this happens, this talk happens, this happens. And it might even just be 3 words. It's literally, fight happens. And then I have to fill in the fight. But I have found that the outlining is actually such a useful tool that I'm glad that I learned to do it. Because at some point, you have so many projects and you're writing so many things that you're just going to forget things. You forget things all the time. And you can't do that.
I find it useful. Well, selling to Daw for the last 12 books, everything's been from a synopsis. So that kind of forces me to do some sort of synopsis up front rather than just launching into the project so that they can say, okay, we'll take this. I'm kind of a mixture, though. It's like the synopsis is maybe 10 pages and it explains the storyline, and then I start writing and I don't look at it again unless I run into a problem in my head that somehow I've forgotten something that I had actually figured out in the synopsis. And I'll go back to it then and say, oh, that's what was supposed to happen. And if I make that happen, maybe this will work out. But yeah, so I guess I'm somewhere in between.
Yeah, I do wish that people would let go of that need to state that they are something. You know, it's just a tool.
You're my 135th or 34th author that I've talked to on the podcast. Whew. So I've heard it all.
You sure have. Oh my gosh.
So there's some that are Kendara Blake, says she just starts with a sentence and keeps writing. And, I always mention, Peter Brett, who, writes 150 page outlines and then just fills them in. So, you know,
oh my gosh.
So there's all extremes and everything.
Oh my
in between.
Gosh.
So once you have whatever your outline looks like, what is your actual writing process? Are you a quill pen on parchment person or, work in coffee shops, or how do you like to work?
Wow, I love quill pens. But anyway, so the other thing that when I first started writing and I had a day job, I said, and this was before cloud storage. Okay, so I'm like, okay, I want to write. I want to write a lot and I still need to work. So I need to not fixate on any specific thing to get the job done. I need to be able to work in 15 minutes during my coffee break. I need to be able to work at home. I need to be able to work when I'm on an airplane. I need to be able to work while people are screaming behind me. So I need to be able to work no matter what word processing I had. So like I actually wrote part of the short story that I sold professionally first with VI on a Unix terminal. So it's like...
But have you ever written on a manual typewriter?
Yes.
Ah, well, there you go.
But the story was not worth anything. So...
At least you got exercise. So.
That's true. You know, you have to whack those things. So I try not to get too fixated on how I do a thing because if I do, I will use that as an excuse not to do the thing. So it's always a process of you eliminate the obstacles. So I say, okay, well, there's no obstacle to me doing this because the draft is in, you know, Dropbox, and I can get to it from anywhere, and I can use anything to type it in. You just have to be able to do it anywhere. So typically I have a file. Now that I have Vellum, I have a Vellum Word template, which I use usually because it makes formatting it later easier. And then I just, wherever, what computer I'm on, if I'm in a coffee shop, I used to be at work, now this is what I do full time. But I do a lot of writing in coffee shops because I do a lot of mom chauffeuring. And so I'm out of the house a lot. But anywhere I can just sit and just do something. Now, I have a couple of peers who are like, you should try dictation. So I've been trying dictation, but there are some technological hurdles there that I haven't quite fixed to my satisfaction.
It takes a lot of editing after you've dictated something.
Yeah, and I wouldn't even try it, except that I realize when I take walks sometimes, I am writing dialogue in my head. I'm like, oh, this next scene, wouldn't it be interesting if they had this conversation? And then I hear the conversation, I'm like, oh no, I can't put it down anywhere. So if I could save those moments, I think it would be useful.
I've done one book that I dictated, but it was a nonfiction book. It was short, and it was helpful because it was drawing on a lot of secondary sources like newspaper articles, and there were quotes that people had said. And it was way faster to just read a quote than to retype a quote. So I found it very helpful for that kind of writing, but I've never tried to write fiction that way. I know David Weber, somebody else I've interviewed, because of injuring his wrists a few years ago, actually dictates his books.
That is interesting.
I imagine it's just something you have to get used to.
Yeah, like everything. I mean, we got used to writing on computers, so.
Yeah, I don't miss the carriage returns. So.
I love handwriting. I love handwriting, but it is more conducive to contemplative writing than it is to getting 400 pages out as quickly as possible.
Yeah, I detest handwriting. The only D I ever got in school, I was an A student, but I got a D in handwriting.
Oh my gosh.
And I had to take notes as a newspaper reporter, which is how I started. And if I didn't type them up right away, I couldn't read them within a day or two. So,
oh my gosh.
As soon as I could type, I was all about the keyboard. I was motivated. I was the fastest typist in my high school typing class because I wanted to learn how to touch type really badly. So, are you a fast writer?
Am I a fast writer? I didn't do a novel in 2.5 months, and that's an okay pace. Like, I'm not straining, but I used to think, okay, much faster is much better, but the faster I write, the less I notice the world around me, and I have come to value, you know, actually living my life. So 2.5 to 3 months is a good compromise between I am writing quickly enough to publish enough to make money, and I am enjoying my family and, you know, actually sleeping at night, all those other good things.
There's a lot to be said for that, yeah.
Yes.
What about the revision process then, once you have a draft?
It's not, okay, so, you know, and I told this to a bunch of new writers too. I'm like, when you first start writing, your first drafts are going to be very difficult to edit and full of errors and full of big mechanical problems that you probably won't be able to solve. The more you write, the more practice you have, the cleaner your drafts are and the less work they need. So now I finish a book, then I post it for my patrons and subscribers, for people who want to read it before it hits press. And I put it up as a Google document that they can leave comments on. And so they go through it and they leave comments. And, you know, half of them will be, here's a typo, or what does this sentence mean? I didn't understand this. They're not trying to edit. They're just honestly confused and they want to know. And then half of them will be, you didn't say this in book 17, or who is this character? You never talked about them before, or how is this possible when you said this XYZ, which I really, really need at this point because
continuity.
I can't keep, I guess the Pelted Verse is over 30 books now. I can't keep all that in my head. It's just not possible. I started a wiki. The wiki is the Bible. I had my readers helped me fill in huge chunks of it. And now we all consult it when we're confused because we all forget things. It's just too much stuff.
I'll bet you there's still inconsistencies here and there.
Oh my gosh, constant inconsistencies. But in a way that's good because that's a chance to add detail. If you say, well, you said in this book that this happened in this, you know, this historical period, and then you said in this book that it happened 10 years later, I can be like, why did I do that? Well, maybe it's, maybe that character was biased. Maybe someone said, maybe it's a calendar problem. Maybe there is, maybe there's conflict about exactly what happened and the records contradict. So you can use that as an opportunity to add some detail, interesting detail, but you have to know, you have to know about it in order to do it and not be caught by surprise. So they go and they read, and I reread the whole thing, and then I read their comments, and then I decide which ones I think are actually actionable, I'll say, and then which ones are just them asking questions that I'm not ready to answer yet because I have something planned and I don't want them to guess about it or whatever. And then after I do all those revisions, then book is done. I hit publish, keep going.
So you're looking after the publishing yourself. Do you bring an editor in? Then it doesn't sound like it.
Oh, no, no. You know, I might have had more qualms about that had I not gone through the early days of traditional publishing and had some editors go through my work.
I don't believe aliens can get along with humans.
Yeah. And so I learned both that editors can be useful and editors can be wrong. Like I had one editor who went through my short story and edited it to his style. And he was very terse. Now at the time I was overly descriptive, but his style of terse was so terse that it was just not me, but I edited it to his standard. And to this day, I still catch myself sometimes being too terse in order. And I'm like, okay, no, that's not what I wanted. So being able to differentiate between the good things that editors give you and the bad things that they accidentally try to enforce on you teaches you that, okay, you don't need an editor. You need an external perspective. If you can get an external perspective, then you're good to go. And so, in the end, the people I need to satisfy are my readers. So having my readers actually go through the books and say, what about this? Or no, this doesn't work. I don't understand this. That gets most of what I need from an external perspective.
And you trust yourself to do the copy editing and proofreading and all that sort of thing?
Oh, no. I mean, I do, but they also catch tons of things. And so I'll have most of my books before they get to press will have had 17 or 18 people looking at them just, and they'll find things, and person A will find different things than person B. So it's, you know, that's another demonstration.
And I'll bet you still find things after it's published.
Always. And in fact, sometimes I'll accidentally add things when I'm fixing them. So it's just, there's never going to be, I found 6 typos in The Hobbit. So there's never going to be perfection.
Yeah,
has to be good enough, you know?
I had one of my books that I put out to Shadowpaw Press, the YA book. I just had an audiobook of it done, and she took note of all the typos she found along the way. So that was a great way to stamp out the few that were still remaining in the book.
Oh,
because reading out loud, one of the best ways to find a typo in your book is to read it out loud in public.
Yes, and I had an audiobook narrator who actually had a spreadsheet for recording errors and questions, and he would just send it to me, and then I'd have to fill in, you know, my changes or not changes. He was good. Crazy guy.
So you've worked in both traditional publishing and now you're publishing yourself. That seems to be, how did that transition happen for you, and are you happy that you made it? Are you still traditionally published as well?
No, I don't have a writing style that lends itself to traditional publishing. I write too fast. You know,
well, there's that, yeah.
You know, I have, you know, this grand arc in this setting is going to need maybe 40 to 50 books. I'm not going to get 40 to 50 books out of most trad pub publishers. They're going to do one a year from me if I sell. It just doesn't work, you know. So I started out trad pub because it was the only thing that was available. So I sold some short stories. And then, you know, I shopped around some novels. I got two that were accepted and both orphaned at their respective publishing houses. And that was bad. Like, that was a horrible experience when TradPub was the only thing that was out there, to have your books, someone say, yes, we want your book. And then 2 months later, oh, this editor is gone and we don't want it after all. Too bad you didn't sign the contract first. It's like, and then I had an agent like also orphan me, because she was all very excited to work for me when I had those acceptances, and when they vanished, so did she. So my experiences were not great. And the fact that it was so constrained, like there were so few opportunities and so few publishing houses, it's just, it wasn't a good fit. So my writing style was never going to fit well with almost any of the opportunities for TradPub. So moving to indie, you know, there was some friction there, because those of us who started before indie was even a thing had that drilled into us, you know, vanity press mm-hmm. is evil. So you have to get over that, and you had to get over the, I'm never going to be in a bookstore, or, you know, it's going to be rare that anybody like wants me to do anything or to be in the rewards, like all that stuff that collects around the art that doesn't have to do with the art. It's just about being part of a group and feeling like you're accepted in the group. You have to let that go, because you're basically a lone wolf at that point. So the transition was hard, but it was so satisfying to be able to do what I wanted to do as fast as I wanted to do and in the way that I wanted to do it, that I don't think I could do it any other way now.
So we are getting close to the end here. So I'm going to ask you my big philosophical questions.
Ooh.
The first one is, you probably touched on it, but summarize it. Why do you write? The second one is, why do you think anybody writes? Why do we do this crazy thing where we try to stick our hallucinations into other people's heads? And the other one then is, why the fantastical specifically? So there you go, your big three philosophical questions.
Why do I write? I write to understand life, I guess. That's the personal answer. The other half of it is, I write to serve God. I never talked about that much, but I feel like it's something that needs more talking about now, because if it's invisible, people think that it doesn't exist. But, you know, I felt like we're all put on this earth for a reason. And even when I was young, I was like, well, I'm good at this. There must be a reason I'm good at this. And so I felt like the reason you're good at this is to serve God's people by writing, by entertaining them, by making them smile, by giving them hope for another day, you know, just to take their worries off their day-to-day thing just for a moment. That's why you're here. So that's why I write. Why do people write? Why do people make art? I think we just need, we're creatures who need meaning. And meaning is a separate layer on top of the day-to-day practicalities of everything. You know, you eat, you drink, you go out, you work, you come home. Those are things you do to survive. But we don't just need to survive. We need to know, why do we survive? What's the purpose of this? Why do we do this? And so when we try to answer those questions, one of our answers is both to make art and to see art. You know, okay, we've made the world beautiful. We've explored a question. We've made people smile. We've, you know, taken them on an adventure. And that's part of the meaning. That's the layer that floats over it, the thing that makes the surviving worthwhile. So, and I do think a lot of art is either contributing to making life worthwhile, or teaching other people how they can find a worthwhile life and discovering for ourselves why life is worthwhile. So it's, you know, the new AI art thing. I'm thinking everyone keeps being too focused on the end product. The end product is only half, maybe even less than half, of the purpose of the art. The other purpose is what it does, what it changes in the artist as they make it. The journey is part of the process. And so that's an entire half that's missing. It's not just about the audience, and it's not just about the artist changing, and it's also about this middle where they meet. So I think that's a sacred thing, really.
Well, on the creation side, I mean, and I actually wrote an essay about this when I was a kid, because which impressed one of my teachers, that if you say that we're created in the image of God, well, what is God but the Creator? So obviously, creativity is going to be part of human nature and something that is built into us. And the mere act of creating, in and of itself, is worthwhile and is serving our greater purpose. So I remember writing an essay about that when I was a kid.
You know, someone sent me a beautiful liturgy for writers of fiction from a website that's called Every Moment Holy. And it's basically, you know, okay, let me serve you through this. Let me do this in your image. If I do it wrong, still use it to your purpose, because this is, you know, this is an act that is creative and that comes from you. And it was just beautiful. So yeah, I think that's important.
And then there was Tolkien's, of course, famous essay about, our poem, actually, where he talks about all the crannies of the worlds we filled with elves and goblins.
Yes, it's so good.
That's it. Love that one. Anyway.
And then, why fantastical? Well, I think the world without mystery disappoints us. Like, we can't know all the answers, because when we think we know all the answers, I think some essential joy leaves us. If every mystery is known and everything can be accounted for. So I think the fantasy, the future, the unknowable, the unicorns, the dragons, the spaceships, all these things that we have to guess at or make up, I think they're part of us acknowledging that you can't have any real meaning or joy in life if you already know every answer.
And that works for me. What are you working on now?
All right. So I just finished the last Kickstarter, which was for book, 63. My next project is the first book in a new series in the same setting, which I'm hoping will be another entry point for people into the setting. So that one is called An Exile Aboard Ship, and I'm hoping it'll be out in summer.
And where can people find you online?
I am at mcahogarth.org and also on Patreon as MCA Hogarth and on Locals as Studio MCH.
And clearly you turn up on Kickstarter from time to time.
And Twitter, yeah, on Twitter.
Well, thanks so much for being on. That was a great conversation. I enjoyed it. I hope you did as well.
I did too. It was wonderful to be on.
And best of luck with all your many, many, many books that you're working.
Thank you so much.
And thanks again to Maggie, MCA Hogarth, for being my guest on this episode of the podcast. I certainly enjoyed that conversation. I hope you did as well. And you'll check out all of the stuff that she's working on, as well as the stuff I'm working on. That would be nice. Let's see, just some housekeeping here to remind you that the World Shapers is online at theworldshapers.com. It's on Twitter at The World Shapers. It's on Facebook at The World Shapers. You can find me at edwardwillett.com, 2 T's on Willett. You can find me on Twitter at ewillett, at Instagram at edwardwillettauthor, on Facebook at edward.willett, and you can find me on YouTube at edwardwillett, where if you'd like, you can walk around my home city of Regina with me from time to time. I live stream those walks fairly frequently, most of the time, unless I'm away or doing something else. So yeah, check that out. You can find Shadowpaw Press, my publishing company, which, among other things, publishes anthologies featuring guests of this podcast. Shapers of Worlds Volume 4 will be out this fall. I've got all the stories in now, and we'll soon be able to announce the lineup of stories. That's at shadowpawpress.com. You can find it online, on Twitter at Shadowpaw Press. You can find it on Instagram at Shadowpaw Press. And there is a YouTube channel, but I haven't put anything there yet, so probably not worth looking for it just yet. I think that's, those are the main three, World Shapers, me, and Shadowpaw Press. And that's it for this episode. So thanks so much for listening. I will be back soon with another interview with another purveyor of fantastical tales as we talk about how they go about creating those tales that we have all enjoyed over the years. That's it for this time. Bye for now.